ask Dr. Dennison to call the roll.
Dr. Philip Bale.
Present.
Ms. Cynthia Harris.
Present.
Mr. Freddie Higdon.
Here.
Mr. Gil Johnson.
Here.
Mr. James Kennedy.
Present.
Dr. Patricia Mentor.
Here.
Mr. David Porter.
Here.
Mr. John Ridley. Ms. Nikki Taylor.
Here.
Mr. Larry Zelke.
Here. And always last.
That Z name, doesn't it?
I'll direct your attention to the minutes that you've received for the special budget approval meeting on June 27, the special call meetings on July 3rd and 10, and the third quarterly meeting on July. I would entertain a motion to approve sets of these minutes.
Second.
Motion is made and second. Any discussion? All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Passes unanimously. Dr. Ransell, would you like to?
I do have a few thoughts to share. First of all, congratulations to Nikki and Travis Taylor. The last time we were together, she wasn't a Taylor. Now she is. So congratulations. And I've been impressed with how SGA and everybody across campus has so quickly picked up on the new name. So congratulations to Nikki and Travis. That's terrific. A couple things. Some of the things at your place will be part of the various agenda items as we go through the morning's agenda. But I do want to call your attention to one booklet. Joseph Kanjemi is with us this morning. Joe Kanjemi and Tony Norman are the co-editors, or editor and associate editor. I guess Joe is the editor of the International Journal of Leadership and Change. Stand up, Joe. Joe Kanjemi has been on our psychology faculty for about 100 years, ever since I was a student at any rate, and is a superb member of our faculty and continues to be a most important part of our academic community and has started this journal. This is the second edition that they have begun to publish, and this one is perhaps a little bit compromised because of one article in it that Joe asked me to do, but at any rate, I'm glad to participate, Joe. But great job. You all will enjoy, and this is something you may want to get on a regular basis. It comes out how often?
Times a year so far.
Okay, so far, okay. But if you'll get these to us when they're published, we'll circulate them to the board. But great work in terms of the leadership and what our faculty are engaged in and engaging faculty from other institutions as well. So it is an international journal, and well done, Joe. You bet. So hope you all enjoy that. A couple things since our last meeting, let me just touch on because they're not likely to be on our agenda elsewhere. You all have been briefed on the results of the recent faculty regent election. We'll swear Barbara Birch in at the end of the meeting and have an opportunity to congratulate Barbara. But 165 faculty voted, and I know at first blush that may not seem like a large number, but Barbara had really stiff competition in this election. She ran unopposed, and you know, it only takes one vote to confirm her election. So actually, I'm quite impressed that 165 faculty chose to vote in the election, affirming their support for Dr. Birch as our new faculty regent. So my compliments to our University Senate and others involved in that important election for our faculty regent. Just as way of closing the loop on a matter that's been on our agenda for the last several months, the Graves-Gilbert Clinic has paid $47,726 for supplies and equipment in the transition of our health clinic. The remaining variable relates to the x-ray equipment, and they will pay on a per-click basis for use of what will remain our x-ray machine. And right now we are negotiating what that per-use rate will be that they will pay. And then when that machine needs to be replaced, Graves-Gilbert will replace it at that point in time. But they were not inclined to purchase that piece of equipment that has received a good bit of use. It was still working fine. So that's the way we'll transition on the X-ray equipment. But that matter is now completed. Those transactions are completed, and I wanted to close the loop with the board on that. I've kept the board a little bit informed as the world's attention has been focused on Ebola across the globe. I think the board is now fully aware that we have only one student in Africa, and she is in Morocco. We have three students on a semester at Sea Voyage, but that voyage has been changed to replace Senegal and Ghana with Italy, Spain, and Morocco. And we do not have any faculty studying in those West African, studying or researching in those West African countries. And we do have one faculty-led study abroad program scheduled for Ghana in 2015, but that one's still under analysis, and we don't know yet whether that one will materialize or not. We'll track that as the months unfold.
We've already pulled the plug on that one.
All right. Okay. All right. We have not made any changes in our admissions policies or practice. We're not going to overreact. We're just going to track closely. And I think it's important for the board to know that we have met with our colleagues with Graves Gilbert Clinic, and we've reviewed all the protocols, and we are fully prepared should a circumstance surface on our campus or in our community that would relate to Ebola. We're fully prepared and ready to deal with that in a thoughtful manner. So about all that should be done is being done in that regard, and we'll track it closely. Our health insurance reserve, I just got the report just a couple of days ago, Jim Cummings. We have a reserve fund balance of $4,793,000, which is up $1.4 million since the beginning of the year. We've had 6 months where we finished in the black in the monthly expenditures for our self-funded health insurance program, and 3 months where we've been in the red over the first 9 months of the year. So our self-funded health insurance program is quite sound, quite stable, and in fact tracking quite positively from a financial standpoint for the current fiscal year. And if anybody would like more specific data, we certainly have that. But the end of September report looks most encouraging for our health insurance, self-funded health insurance program. Sometimes it's important for the board to know how we track on our students that receive federal or state money. I got this report from Financial Aid a few days ago. Our Pell Grant expenditures from federal resources is slightly over $27 million. 7,145 students on Pell Grants from the federal government, which is 34.7% of our undergraduate enrollment, receive Pell Grant support. State grants and scholarship expenditures is slightly over $15 million. That would include the Keys program, I would presume. Of our students with eligible for aid, undergraduate students, we have 4,131 students with a family income under $60,000 and 5,227 students with income over $60,000. And then those are dependent students that have family support. We have 3,890 independent undergraduate students eligible for aid. 2,314 of them with income less than $20,000, 868 with zero. And of those independent students, 1,576 with income over $20,000. These are numbers we track pretty closely that also correlate with default rates with loans, and many of these have significant student loans. But in terms of Pell Grants, federal and state grant dollars, that gives you some sense of the significant number of students that are dependent upon either state or federal aid to be a WKU student. Just got the report a few days ago from the NCAA. Our athletic programs have a graduation rate of 80%, which is slightly up from 79% last year. Three teams, golf, softball, and volleyball, had 100% graduation. Just for comparative purposes, University of Kentucky is 81, University of Louisville is 80, and those are the three highest in the Commonwealth. And we are continuing to take pride in the academic performance and graduation rate of our student athletes. But this is the most recent graduation success rate data from the NCAA, and that currently where we have been leading the pace in the Sun Belt Conference in that regard. We're currently fifth out of 14 current members in Conference USA. So as we move up in athletic competition, the academic competition is equally in a higher level. So we will continue to track that and support the academic performance of our student athletes. Finally, the first annual ranking of the 50 best online colleges and universities was released on October 1 from College Choice, an independent college search and rankings website. WKU, these were listed in alphabetical order, so we don't know where we rank in the top 50, but WKU is included in the 50 best online institutions. Over the past 12 years, the amount of students taking at least one higher education course online has grown from 1.6 million to 7.1 million. And according to this report, yet there are some colleges and universities that stand above the rest in terms of quality of education, student engagement, affordability, and selection of online degrees. So, Beth Lavis, congratulations. It's good to be in the top 50. Well done. Thank you. So those are just some thoughts and information that's come across my desk in the last couple of weeks, and thought that would be a good way to start our meeting.
That is a good way. There are compliments on a lot of those and the challenges on a few, so that's an interesting report.
Thank you.
I'll direct your attention to the agenda. The committees of the board met on September 26th and discussed all of the items on their agendas. And there were consent agenda covers all items with the exception of the items at 1.3, 2.2, and 3.2. And these items are exempt from the agenda coverage and will be discussed and voted on separately as we go through the committee reports. This time I'll call on Regent Bale for the academic report.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we have only three agenda items, which we will consider separately. But before we entertain those, I would like to ask Provost Emsley to make a comment or two and an introduction. And as we like to do in this committee, we like to add a little pizzazz to the meeting, and I think we're going to do that this morning.
Okay.
That's some pizzazz.
First, I'd like to introduce Amber Scott. Amber Scott is the new assistant to the provost, sitting over here, and is duly indoctrinated in the process of preparing materials for board meetings, working with Dr. Sylvia Geico behind me. Teresa Jackson, my former assistant, has retired after about 30 years at WKU. Amber's been on the job for just over a month, and picking up just fine. Comes to us from HR, Tony sitting over in the corner, you know, growling at me. But welcome, Amber. I'd also like to introduce Brent Bjorkman, who's sitting over in there. Brent's a clinical assistant professor in the folk studies area and currently serves as the interim director of the Kentucky Museum. And he's here for a couple of reasons. One, we're pursuing AAM accreditation, and Brent's the responsible for seeing that through. He's also going to work with the board, Philip. And Brent's here just to kind of observe how the board machinations work so he can play his role there. So, Brent, welcome aboard. And last but not least, Gaynor Newman. Gaynor is the new director of our world champion forensics team. Dr. Katz and I were sharing notes this morning. We're wearing our world champion forensics watches, as is President Ransdell. And without further ado, I'm going to bring Gaynor up to say a few words. Gaynor.
Thank you very much, Dr. Emsley. As you said, my name is Dana Newman. I'm the new director of forensics here at WKU. As many of you know, we have a tremendous legacy of success in forensics here at Western Kentucky University. And I consider myself very lucky to be a part of that legacy as both a competitor and as a coach. But as most of you do not know, I was not with the university last year. I was with a different team. And so I had a unique opportunity to witness the tremendous and extraordinary accomplishments of the team from a very different perspective. And let me say, it was something that was truly extraordinary. So I want to welcome the person who made it all possible, the former director of forensics and the current director of recruitment, Jace Lux.
So I've been asked to speak about forensics one more time. it's a pleasure to do so. It's something that is and always will be near and dear to my heart. And thank you, Dr. Bale, for encouraging this presentation along. I made a mistake telling Dr. Bale that a video existed of the awards ceremony from the national tournament last year. And he said, "We've got to show that at a Regents meeting." And every now and again throughout the summer, I would get a text message or a phone call. Okay, can we do that video? So today, and today only, we'll show the video of the awards ceremony. But I did just want to put into perspective the accomplishments of the students that were members of last year's team. Many of them are on a bus to Peoria, Illinois, for what is the team's largest tournament of the fall semester right now. Some of you may have heard these or read these in press releases, but just to give a little bit of context before we show the video, this is what the forensic students were able to accomplish last year. So at the national tournament, prior to 2014, the previous number of students making it to the quarterfinal round of competition from any one team was 67, and we actually set that record in 2013. This year, that number increased to 73, and that was also accomplished by WKU students. The previous number of events making it to the semifinal round of competition at the NFA National Tournament was 35. That was set in 2013 by Bradley University. We topped that mark this year with 44. Previous number of students making it to a national final round of competition was set by Bradley in 2013 with 21. We had 28 in April of this year. Previous number of national champions at the national tournament from one team was a three-way tie between Eastern Michigan University in 1979, Miami University of Ohio in 2003, and Bradley in both 1992 and 2013. This year, we had seven. Now, to put that in a little bit finer context, there are 11 total events at the national tournament in which students can compete. And our students captured seven of the 11 national championships at this year's national tournament. So, a pretty impressive mark. Previous number of total points earned by a team at the national tournament was by Bradley in 2013 with 771.5. This year, we had 840.5. And the previous largest margin of victory was Bradley won the tournament with 285 more points than anyone else. This year, we had 331.5 more points than anyone else. So if you see a forensic student on campus, make sure to congratulate them for their accomplishments. So here is the video. I hope the sound quality is okay. There were perhaps some expletives uttered as people gasped and heard the total points, people from other teams, so we had to do a little bit of editing on the sound for content at this meeting.
509 points in second place, Bradley University.
Had five 509 points for second place. Come to my office, I'll play it for you later if you want. So, team kind of has a goal that was established when we were attending the International Forensic Association's World Championship Tournament every year. We don't do that every year anymore for budgetary reasons, but the four goals that the team typically has are to win the state championship, the world championship, the AFA National Championship, and the NFA National Championship. We remain the only team in the history of collegiate forensics to accomplish that feat, to win all four of those. And we have now, adding 2014 onto that, accomplished that six times. So, and there's our fearless leader making sure we remember what those four goals are. So, I thank you all for allowing me the responsibility of leading our team. And if you would have asked me a year ago what I would be doing today, this year, I would say I'm probably going to a forensics tournament with the team. But life takes turns, and I'm fortunately able to serve the university in a different capacity now. But you're truly in good hands with Gaynor, and I'll turn it back over
to
him.
So, Gaynor, as an undergraduate debater here and now our coach, where'd we loan you for the last few years?
You loaned me to Illinois State University.
Okay, which is a close competitor to Bradley. So
they are, yeah.
We
were hitting them all the time, and it was a really tremendous thing. But frankly, the activity is about so much more than getting trophies, and I definitely want you all to know that. It's about transforming the lives of tomorrow's leaders. It's about leaders like Mario Nguyen, who is a student. He's a first-generation American. His mother is an undocumented immigrant. And he's the first of his family to go to college, and he's now at Harvard Law. And so WKU, for instance, the opportunity that we provide is about so much more than that. It's about truly shaping the lives of tomorrow's leaders. So we thank you so much for all of your continued support, and thank you so much for having us.
Thank you all for humoring me with that, but I think everyone, I'm sure, enjoyed it. And, you know, I shouldn't be lost in the fact that I don't know any other university in our Commonwealth that can claim number one status in anything academic. And to prepare these young people who can get up and present themselves well, as someone that gets a little stage fright even before these meetings, I mean, I really think that's fantastic that we have that many students who are achieving at such a high level. And Gaynor, you're following a couple of legends now, so I'm sure you'll keep it up. But thanks for sharing that with us. All right, with that, we'll move on to our action items, which we're going to consider separately. The first is approval of the Doctor of Psychology and Applied Psychology.
Move approval.
Second.
A motion and a second. Any discussion?
Did this have to go through the council post-secondary?
Yeah, just going to ask Gordon to walk the board through that process.
It's a complicated process getting a new program approved, particularly this one, which will be our fourth applied doctorate program, and which will take us to level six, the highest level achievable in the SAC COC hierarchy. Pending approval by the board today, the next step is to take it to the CPE at its meeting on November 21. We will also, in parallel with that, be submitting a prospectus to SAC COC for the new degree type. And if all that comes together, we'll be admitting our first class of students in the coming fall. But yeah, it takes an appropriately long time to get a degree of this nature.
Other universities have this degree?
Yes. Eastern Kentucky University had their Doctor of Psychology degree approved by the council at its meeting in September. As we discussed the committee, they're complementary degrees in many ways. Okay. And when we present to the council, when the council staff presented the Eastern degree, they alluded to ours as being, you know, covering the other areas. Dr. Greer, do you want to comment on that?
In terms of, well, our program is going to be focused mainly on folks who already have master's degrees, so we will be bringing in people who have already had some training in psychology or other areas to give them that extra step to get the doctoral degree that will help out in terms of being able to practice independently and really focus a lot on supervising other people's practice, especially at the master's level. I think Eastern Kentucky's program is going to focus a lot more on rural health in Appalachia. So we'll complement that way, and not necessarily be fighting for this people who have certain types of interest.
And as discussed at the committee meeting, there is a dearth of mental health professionals in Kentucky, in rural areas particularly, and so I don't think we can produce too many of them. Any other questions or comments? If not, all those in favor of approval say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, likewise. Motion passes.
Mr. Chairman, if before we move on to the next item, we have some members of the faculty in that department here. Sam, the Dean of the College of Education and Behavioral Sciences, is here. So if the faculty in this department would stand up. This is as thorough and as focused a degree program proposal as we've seen in a long time. It's really, really well done. So congratulations to everybody involved.
Our next action item concerns approval of an emerita faculty appointment. And Minter, would you like to make your comment?
Absolutely. It would be my honor to do so. Our emeriti could not be with us this morning, but I want to sing their praises for their collective service and wisdom that they've shared with the university and with the Potter College of Arts and Letters. Up for consideration this morning is Lauren Nathiason. And Professor Nathiason, for 30 years, exceeded all of the commitment levels that one would expect of WKU faculty members in their professional lives. She is a specialist in printmaking, and her stewardship of that area was tireless and worked with our students to make sure that they had the best possible experience in her facility. Her teaching, which inspired many, was highlighted by creative, well-organized assignments. Whether she was instructing beginning or advanced art majors or teaching the general education course of art appreciation to non-art majors. Maybe most importantly was her position as a role model for emerging artists, and her career could not have been more instrumental, and particularly in her commitment to the area of studio practice. All artists have people who are inspired by their work, and her list of nationally significant solo, small group, juried competitions, and people whose work she inspired provides clear evidence of a highly respected artist whose work was she was active, relevant in the mediums of drawing and painting and printmaking. And secondly, we have for consideration Dr. Lou Ann Crowther, who was an associate professor of English. And she came to WKU in 1984 and was an outstanding classroom teacher. As a junior faculty member, she helped to organize the university's first Women's Studies Conference, and she was one of the key people in that conference when I came here in 1993. She was also a central figure in the African American Studies program, in particular teaching a highly successful course in African American literature, the first time that was offered in the department. Lou Ann is also a poet, and she presented and wrote a scholarship on pedagogical issues. And in the last few years, her work focused on the Harlem Renaissance, which is something that is of great interest to me. And she worked through not just on the campus, but in the community, working for Habitat for Humanity, Girls Inc., taught in Governor's Scholars, and was also a member of the Cultural Enhancement Committee. And finally, her honors, very appropriately, included being named a woman of achievement by the Bowling Green Human Rights Commission. And taking a point of personal privilege, I miss seeing her every day in Cherry Hall. It is my honor to move for approval for emeriti status for these two deserving retired faculty members.
Second. I have a motion and a second. Any further discussion, comments? If not, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Motion passes. Our next item was not discussed at the committee meeting, and I'll ask Provost Emsley to make a comment about honorary doctorate.
Every fall, the Office of Academic Affairs puts out a call for nominations for honorary degrees. We have about 8 or 9 different kinds of honorary degree. This year we did receive a nomination, which is then reviewed by a committee, faculty, staff, students. That committee unanimously endorsed the nominee you say before you. That was sent to me for endorsement, and I think Rich Miller could tell you one of the quickest endorsements of anything brought to my desk I ever made. So before you today is an action item to award a Doctor of Public Service degree to Mr. Don Disney. We award honorary doctorates to those who have made, and I quote, exemplary contributions to the university, the state, the nation, and the world. Don is founder and chairman of the board of the United Medical Corporation. Active and passive roles in many companies, including, interestingly, an investment group that purchased the Bowling Green Hot Rods in 2013. He was a transfer student at WKU, attended through 1964. And while here he worked at the hospital, where he was mentored by a variety of individuals, notably a Miss Helen Turner, and recently Mr. Disney presented a very substantial gift to create a facility at our health sciences complex in memory of Miss Turner. And I'd like to invite Dean John Bonaguro of the College of Health and Human Services to add a few words. John.
Glad to. Thank you. Mr. Disney is really reflected as a public servant and hence the doctor for a public service area. He's originally from Eastern Kentucky. He came to Bowling Green as the provost eventually was mentored by Ms. Turner. He started as an orderly. Came from a low-income area in Eastern Kentucky. Came here, became an orderly. Got a degree related to respiratory therapy. Came into healthcare, started off with Humana, went through the ranks, but he's always given back to his community. You talk with him like we have personally, talks about the experiences that he gives back to the community that which he lives and resides. He's often even done mission trips internationally to help communities better themselves. He's always been giving back, and his gift to here, to WKU, Helen Turner, is actually for scholarship preparing nurse leaders. And Mary Bennett is here, and Mary would like to say a few words about the gift that
We made the Nursing Learning Center, which consists of our major bed labs and our simulation center, in the honor of Ms. Turner, who was a nurse and chief nurse officer in the Bowling Green Medical Center. And he wanted this money to go for nursing students to do activities that they couldn't ordinarily afford to do. So this is being used for international experiences, for high-level internships, and we had a student go to Mayo Clinic last summer on one of these internships, and we're hoping to get more students accepted at these high-level opportunities because of having some of this money, and also to present at high-level conferences. So we are going to use this money to enhance student engagement, and we are grateful for that. We're going to look for more opportunities after this month. He did his summer clinic at Mayo. He was asked several times, where did you come from? Where did you go to school? They were so impressed with him. I know we're going to get more opportunities at that highly competitive level.
Thank you.
It's hardly reason for an honorary doctorate, but it is kind of cool. Those of you that are horse racing fans, Don is a very active breeder and has a horse named Bahamian Squall running in Saturday's Breeders' Cup Championship race at Santa Anita. So just whatever that's worth. little inside the tip there, bet on the Bahamian Squall.
Maybe he'll name one of his horses Topper someday. I'll entertain a motion.
So move.
I have a motion and a second by Larry for approval of honorary doctorate appointment as described. Any discussion, other comments? not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, like sign. Motion passes.
Appreciate that, and I believe Mr. Disney will be receiving his degree at this fall commencement on December 13 in the morning ceremony.
Yes, he will come in that Friday afternoon on the 12th, and he and Irene will join us for dinner that evening on Friday evening and the morning ceremony Saturday morning at our fall commencement. He'll receive his doctorate at that time.
Will he be asked to speak?
Briefly, yes. Okay. He will acknowledge receipt of the degree, yes.
All right, we have a couple of other information items. Provost?
Leading American University International Reach, one of the elements of that is our vibrant study abroad program. And I need to introduce Laurie Monarch, or Laurie usually, who comes to us from Georgetown University as Director of Overseas Study. She's been here several months now. She's earned a BA in International Relations from Tufts University, a Master of Education at the University of Vermont. And true to the cause, she's a past recipient of both the Congress Bundestag Award and a Fulbright. So she's here to tell you about the continued growth and success of our study abroad program. Laurie.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here with you this morning to talk a little bit about the state of study abroad here at WKU. You may have had a chance to review the one-pager that was prepared for your agenda packet, where I shared a little bit of data and statistics and some general information. I also want to draw your attention to a report that was released just yesterday. Each of you should have one at your desk there. It's the 2013-2014 annual report produced by the Office of International Programs and Study Abroad and Global Learning. So you'll find a lot of really good news in there, actually, and I hope that you'll be able to take some time to look through it. And it does go into more detail than I'll be able to do with you this morning, but I do want to take just the next, hopefully, 10 minutes or so to go into a little bit more detail about some of the information I shared in your agenda packet. I also would like to talk with you just a little bit about the benefits of study abroad, why we focus on it so much here at WKU, and why I very strongly believe we should continue to do so. And then lastly, just the last couple of minutes, I wanted to touch on a few things that I've seen as emerging priorities. Things that I need to focus on, that I believe we need to focus on as an institution in order to continue to make progress towards our study abroad participation goals. So starting right off with some terrific news, this chart, if you can see it, shows that we have actually experienced tremendous growth in our study abroad participation here at the university just in the last 4 years. The growth rate is actually higher than 50%, which is fantastic news. Just since 2010, 2011. And that would be an outstanding record by any measure, but it's particularly remarkable when you consider the fact that the national growth rate for the most recent four-year period for which data are available was actually less than 9%. So we're really doing very good things here in terms of encouraging more students to study abroad. Another really positive data point is that we also ranked on a national report that looks at international student mobility and study abroad in the U.S., the Open Doors Report, which is produced every year by the Institute for International Education. In the most recent report, WKU ranked number 32 on the list of top 40 master's degree-granting institutions in terms of total study abroad numbers. We were the only public institution in Kentucky to appear anywhere in the Open Doors rankings. So that's something, in my opinion, we should be shouting from the rooftops. It's really fantastic. It's quite an accomplishment. I also wanted to touch on why, I've only been here for a few months, but to me, I've already identified a few factors, actually four primary factors, that I think have contributed to this growth over the last few years. And I'll talk about each of them in a little bit more detail as I progress through the presentation. The first is the resources that have been put into scholarship funding for our students. As we know, Funding is a major concern for a lot of students here at WKU, and certainly is a barrier to study abroad for a lot of them. So the scholarship funding is really very, very important. And again, I'll go into more detail in just a minute. The second factor I would say is the tremendous effort that has been put into creating outreach and promotional activities and events to really get the word out to students across campus that study abroad is an option for them. The third factor I would say is the effort that has been put into identifying a diverse array of program options so that we can really say we're moving towards having some one option, or at least one option, for virtually every student. So we have different types of programs available that fall outside of what we would call the traditional study abroad program that used to only be for a single semester or a full academic year. The last factor, and I think this is actually the most important, but I wanted to save it for last, is that the focus on the importance of internationalization comes from the very highest levels of our administration. So without that, I think that it would be very difficult for us to move forward. The fact that internationalization goals were included in the Challenging the Spirit action plan was also significant, and I was very glad to see that.
Ms. Monarch, before you move on, of the 642, how many of those are unique students versus how many of them are doubled in that number?
That would be, all of them would be unique students, actually.
Okay, 642 is unique.
Yes.
Do you know what the number of students going on any kind of study abroad opportunity are? Like number of trips, you want to think about it that way.
If
number
a student goes on more than one study
abroad, that's what I'm at. Yeah.
The total number of study abroad
experiences. Right, like is that 642, does that include someone who goes on two trips? Or is
my
that
my understanding is that this does not currently include that number. I'm not sure if we go into more detail about that in the annual report looking at, that's something that we do want to capture. We do know that we do have repeat students.
Yeah.
Obviously, they would only be counted twice in any sort of number if they studied abroad twice in one academic year. But
yeah, I didn't
we
see that broken out in the report. I read it yesterday online.
Okay. Yeah. That's something that I can look into and get to you later if you'd like.
Fantastic.
Be happy
thanks.
To listen to that.
Sure.
Of that number, only 3.7% of them had ever studied abroad. The entire rest of that number, it was their first time studying abroad. It doesn't get your question directly, but the number of repeaters in that number, if that's the case, would be pretty small.
Okay. Yeah, that'd just be good to know as you kind of drill down and figure out who
absolutely.
Your constituency is.
Because we want students to repeat. So, and we have certain experiences that we would consider to be sort of gateway experiences that hopefully encourage students to study abroad multiple times. I will look into that. Okay, I talked a little bit about outreach. I wanted to just give you a quick overview of the primary activities from my office, Study Abroad and Global Learning. Outreach, of course, is a significant component of what we do. I would say, in a nutshell, that we are responsible for offering comprehensive advising support to all of our students throughout the entire study abroad experience. So starting with the first time we run across a student at a promotional event to their first visit to our office. Pre-departure orientation is, of course, also key. We support students while they're abroad. And then we also try to help them on the re-entry process when they return to WKU. Frankly, that the last aspect of our mission is something I think we need to work on a little bit more moving forward, but that is also part of what we do. One program I wanted to highlight is what we call the SAGL Student Representative Program. It's something we're really proud of. It was developed just a few years ago, and it is basically a core of volunteer students who've already studied abroad, who return to WKU. They're very enthusiastic and excited about their experiences, and they want to share those experiences with their peers. It's a competitive program to get into. Last year, I can tell you that we had 14 students who participated. This year, that number increased to 22. They really are outstanding students, and they contribute in significant ways to our outreach efforts in particular. Last year, the 14 students in that core group delivered more than 100 classroom presentations and participated in an array of other promotional and marketing events. This year, with even more students, we're hoping to increase that number even further, but I think more importantly, we're looking at ways that we can be more strategic about our outreach in terms of connecting with faculty in specific departments and really targeting areas where we need further development. So that's something that we're looking at as we move forward. This graph here on the right, I just wanted to show you a little bit about our highlighting one of our most significant events, or actually two, because we have two study abroad fairs every year. You can see here that there's growth. Unfortunately, I neglected to leave the or to put the numbers in there, but over each of the last 2 years, we had just under 1,000 students participate in the study abroad fairs in the fall and the spring combined. The significant growth that you see here, I wanted to point out, is actually just for our fall fair alone. So the increase is even greater than it looks at first glance. That can be attributed almost exclusively, I would say, to a decision that was made to connect the fall study abroad fair with the annual majors and minors fair. We did that in an effort to more clearly demonstrate to students the connection between their study abroad experience and their academic course of study here on campus. That's something, frankly, that we struggle with quite a bit in study abroad, is helping students to understand that it is first and foremost an academic undertaking and not a trip, so to speak. So hopefully we managed to do that a little bit by connecting those two fairs. Scholarships, just to give you a little bit more detail, I mentioned that that's a significant factor for us as well. Some basic figures here. Last year, we awarded more than $160,000 in World Topper money, World Topper scholarship money to our students. The next category I wanted to explain in a little bit more detail, because the amount, $15,000, is not necessarily indicative of the significance of what we call the Alternative Gilman and Gilman Supplemental Grants. The Gilman Award is actually a national competitive scholarship for study abroad that targets specifically students who have traditionally been underrepresented in study abroad, and in particular those with high financial need. Students have to be Pell Grant recipients to qualify for the Gilman Scholarship. Unfortunately, because it is so competitive, not all of our students actually receive a Gilman of those who apply, so two scholarship funds were created to support those students in particular. The first, the Alternative Gilman, supports students who applied for a Gilman but did not receive one. The second, the Gilman Supplemental, supports students who did receive a Gilman but find that it wasn't quite enough to be able to fund their study abroad experience. So the numbers are small, but it is significant for a key group of students for us. Also along those lines, I wanted to highlight the Diversity Abroad Grant, which was implemented last year. In the first year of the program, $50,000 was awarded to 35 students. The award is meant to support study abroad for students, again, from underrepresented and diverse backgrounds. In the first year, it focused primarily on African American students, and you can see that we experienced tremendous growth just in 1 year. In fact, in terms of raw numbers, the growth was almost 200%. I think it was 193% to be exact. To explain what this chart is, where it says national average, that's also taken from the Open Doors report that I referenced earlier. So if you look at the total number of students in the U.S. who study abroad, in the most recent year for which data are available, about 5.3% of those students were African American. You can see that 2 years ago, our own percentage was pretty far below that. And then thanks largely, I believe, to the DAG, that percentage increased to almost 8% last year. And we intend to continue this program. We think we are going to continue to see outstanding results. And I'm really pleased to say that the WKU Sisterhood awarded us a very generous grant of $20,000 earlier this month in support of that program. I wanted to touch a little bit on the application fee, which was, of course, implemented prior to my arrival here at WKU, but I thought you might be interested to see some of the results and where that money has gone since it was implemented, I guess, about a year and a half ago. So in terms of revenue, I believe it was implemented halfway through the 2012-2013 academic year. Income from the fee was just right around $50,000. Last year, of course, it spanned the full academic year and was doubled to just over $100,000. What I believe is most important here is to show you how that money was actually spent. And to summarize, I would say that it went, of course, to support our students, which is what it needed to do. 69% of that funding has gone to support our scholarships, some of the funds that I mentioned just a minute ago. The other large chunk that you see here, 27%, was for the purchase and now also the maintenance of Studio Abroad. Studio Abroad is our online application software that we have used to streamline the application process for our students. We're still working out some kinks with it, but we're getting there. And the idea there is that with this improved, enhanced application system, we will actually improve access to study abroad for our students. We'll make the process more transparent and more easily accessible. What we're going to be rolling out, hopefully within the next couple of months, is another component of Studio Abroad that relates to risk management for the university. So those plans are in the works. It will enable us to also track faculty and staff who travel internationally on college, or on university rather, business. And that, of course, is important to us so that we can know how to contact people in the event of an emergency, and we know where people are. So we're going to be moving forward with that in the next couple of months. And just a couple more slides. I mentioned that I wanted to touch a little bit on the impact of study abroad and why I believe it's so great that we focus on it to the extent that we do here at WKU. In essence, you could look at study abroad as a high-impact educational activity. And research shows that those high-impact types of activities result in increased engagement. Students return and generally speaking, are more engaged in their own learning when they come back to campus. Research then also shows that increased engagement results in positive outcomes like higher GPAs, increased retention rates, and a greater chance of graduating on time. Those, of course, are all positive outcomes, not just for our students, but for the institution as a whole, as we look at those metrics that we all know are so important. The last two things here just meant to show the two typical paths that students take once they do graduate. Studies also show that study abroad increases a student's likelihood of continuing on to graduate school. And for those who do not choose to go to graduate school, it also leads to better job prospects. One study from 2012 from IES, which is a major study abroad program provider based in Chicago, showed that students who studied abroad had starting salaries on average that were $7,000 higher than their peers who did not study abroad. That's huge. 97% of study abroad students also were able to locate gainful or find gainful employment within the first year of graduation. So these are some of the things we need to be sharing with our students to encourage even more and more of them to study abroad. And the last slide, as I mentioned, I wanted to talk just a little bit about what I'm calling emerging priorities. Obviously, this is great news. The university has made fantastic strides in study abroad participation over the last few years. I think in order to move forward, we need to look at a few areas, and I in particular will be responsible for looking at these areas in collaboration with others. The first I would call, I'll start at the top, is actually campus-wide collaboration. I think that in order to continue to make progress, we really need to recognize as a university that student recruitment and program development are university-wide responsibilities. I think if a lot of that effort continues to be centralized and just one office and among all of the fantastic faculty who already do participate in study abroad and lead programs, it'll be difficult to move forward. So what I'd like to see us do is to continue to build connections and strengthen ties among all of the various offices on campus that have a hand in study abroad. And by that I mean, of course, my office, but also the Office of International Programs, DLO, but also other administrative units like the Registrar's Office and Financial Aid. All of these various players have the ability to impact our participation rate. Moving on to vision and message, what I mean by this is I think we need to look at how we can continue to infuse the importance of internationalization in general and study abroad in particular into virtually every aspect of how we choose to market WKU. So some ideas I mentioned, I was to Jace this morning that I was glad to meet him because I was going to reference him in my presentation. So Dr. Cobain and I will be meeting with Jace in just a few weeks to begin to talk about ways, for example, that we can look at our admissions materials, both in print and online, to try to build in more references to study abroad. I believe, of course, from my point of view, that we should try to ensure that prospective students and their parents begin to associate internationalization and study abroad with WKU from the very first moments that they come into contact with us. I think there are also a few smaller things that we could look at doing that might seem pretty minor, but I think all add up to sort of promoting this image of WKU as an international institution. I think we need to encourage our faculty and staff, whenever possible, to include information about their own international experiences and their online biographical sketches. I'd like to speak with deans and department heads about ways to work towards including more references to internationalization in departmental mission statements, descriptions of programs of study, those sorts of things as well. And lastly, I'd like to really make sure that we work closely with media relations to ensure that we are aggressively promoting those successes that we already have. That number 32 ranking, for example, should be out there. We should be putting that out there at every possible opportunity. The last factor here that I wanted to touch on is curriculum integration. I think that looking at ways that we can ensure that all students have the opportunity to study abroad through curricular integration is going to impact our ability to meet both our quantitative and our qualitative study abroad goals. By that, I mean that, of course, we want more and more students to study abroad whenever possible, but we also want them to study abroad on the highest quality programs that we can possibly identify. So to that end, I'm looking forward to, in the next coming months, I'd like to start working more closely with, again, with deans and department heads to try to work together to identify a slate of programs for each department that specifically meet the academic goals that have been set for students in those departments, and then working together to market those programs effectively to those students. The idea here is that we want to ensure not just that study abroad is possible for every student, but that it can actually be an integral part of virtually all courses of study here at the university. So with that, I'd like to thank you again for the opportunity to be here with you today, and are there any other questions that I can help address?
Is there, I'm curious, my son was in France when he was at center, he was taking French as his major. Is there a higher correlation with study abroad with foreign language students?
Traditionally, yes.
That's what I've thought. So out of that percentage or that number you had there, how many? Half?
Not actually. Traditionally that has been the case, but that I think nationwide the trend is moving away from that. And certainly at WKU, I think a large percentage of our study abroad students actually come from education and other business, lots of different fields. Okay. It used to be that foreign language knowledge was required mm-hmm. for study abroad unless you went to England, Australia, or New Zealand,
right.
typically. That's no longer the case. More and more countries, including those in Western Europe, are developing English language programs specifically to target study abroad students.
Okay. A couple of years ago, I was with Freddie at the track.
He doesn't go to the track.
I wrote that horse. I wrote that down, Gary. And he introduced me to the English fella who runs the program for Western.
Right.
So, and he had a building. I mean, I remember talking to him. Do all the study abroad people go to a facility like we have or have an association
well,
with
probably
in England?
Met Gordon Kingsley, who was principal at Harlaxton, and that he retired this past year. That was his full-time position. He was the principal for that school called Harlaxton, which receives 160 to 170 American students each semester for 15-hour course credit. Harlaxton is owned by the University of Evansville, and we're the largest partner with the University of Evansville.
I see.
And sending students to Harlaxton to study. We'll send 30 to 40 each semester to Harlaxton for that 15 hours credit, 6 British faculty, and then we have a faculty member or more or two there each semester, and that rotates among our faculty. But it's it is study abroad, but it is in English. In fact, there's a 6-hour, very difficult British studies course that those students take at Harlaxton.
So is it a like institution at all the other countries that we send students to?
No, that's a unique circumstance. Again, University of Evansville owns that campus, that manor house, and where we developed that partnership with them several years ago. But no, there's not a... quite that same model in other countries. Most of our programs, our faculty will create a faculty-led study abroad program in a given country. China's probably the other country where there's a higher level of sophistication because we have partner institutions, the Confucius Institute, the Chinese flagship program requires study in China, so on. So every country, every dynamic, every study abroad course is a little different. And biology, has a pretty consistent track record in Africa and Ecuador and mm-hmm. other places. So it's they're all different.
Everywhere.
And there's the host family model, too. I mean, I just wrote a letter for a student who's applying for a program in Argentina where he'll live with a host family. And part of it is to improve his Spanish and really have that cultural immersion. So, I mean, that's a fantastic model.
Do we send people to Cuba?
We have. Well, we're now doing a Hemingway course in Cuba that will go for the third time this January. It started the year before last. Walter Rutledge is the English faculty member who leads that course, and we'll 25 or so students, Craig?
We've had that high. This year the numbers are a little bit lower. I think we're in the low teens at the moment.
For our Ernest Hemingway course mm-hmm. in Cuba, that we now have all the clearances, and now that's become kind of an annual thing. It's mm-hmm. Now we'll say Sam Evans.
He just left.
Just left. We sent 30 plus teachers abroad to do their student teaching abroad this past year. So now.
It was 86 last year.
About 30% of our student teachers, as I recall. There's a 30 in there somewhere, I'm pretty sure.
I heard you say 86. I don't know if everybody else did.
86 students did their student teaching abroad and all over the globe. And that's a dynamic just in the last 3 or 4 years. That's really been an amazing experience. And student teachers who put that on their resume, superintendents and principals really take notice of that when it comes to hiring elementary, middle grade, and high school teachers. So we're looking at lots of different dimensions, and great job, Laurie. This is very helpful, very informative, and well done.
Well, I wanted to say, I mean, I'm a believer in this. I'm going to be leading my fourth study abroad this winter. We leave on December 26th to go to London, study London in the Age of Revolutions. I have 14 students who are going with me on the CCSA program. And I think 6 of them are from other institutions. 8 of them are from WKU and 6 are from other institutions. So those kind of collaborative programs are really, really important, and it'll be a good experience for our students to have students from other institutions there. So I'm excited about it. I'm a believer. And I'm a study abroad alum myself. I was a junior when I went, and it was life-changing for me.
You're going to study Charles Dickens there?
We're not studying Charles Dickens, but we're studying Benjamin Franklin, going to Dr. Johnson's house, going to Parliament, doing a slavery and abolition walk. It's going to be good stuff. I did want to ask, since the board had sent the study abroad fee to audit 2 years ago or a year and a half ago, the 69% study of money that's going into study abroad fare and whatever else you said, scholarships. What is the fraction? Because that's not something that came out in the audit, because, again, I know the fee's been fully developed since then. But what's the split in that 69%? How much is going to scholarships versus study abroad fare?
Actually, just to clarify, the entire 69% was for scholarships.
2% for study abroad fare.
Okay, that's in there.
One of those.
Okay. And which scholarships is it funding?
It funds partially the World Topper and scholarship, and also the Diversity Abroad grant.
Okay, mm-hmm. So it's going into that.
Yes, and I believe the Alternative Gilman as well, and Supplemental Gilman.
Yes, they helped with that. Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks.
Sure, you're welcome. Thank
Laura,
you.
Laura, I think I'm going to nominate Larry and Dr. Minner and Dr. Ranch. It'll be 3 of the rooftops that you need shot.
Very good. Very good, thank you. I appreciate
that. You can volunteer. Nice presentation, thank you. Brian, you want to give us an update on enrollment?
Do that.
Been on a job for 3 months.
I believe Julia's floating the enrollment report around to you, or reports. There's multiple ones this time. Also, hopefully at your desk, you'll find the View Book, which is a new publication in our cache of inventory of recruitment documents that Dr. Lux and his team and marketing and publications have helped us with. I think you'll be pleased with seeing the View Book. If that's not at your desk, we'll make sure we get that to you. The enrollment arms race moves forward, as we like to say. It's always with us. I asked probably 3, 5, 6, 8 times a day, what's the number, what's the number? Well, since this was last week, and this report is the official census enrollment report. This is the one I'm talking from at the moment. We've added a few lines there on the 10-year trend. The top would be the total enrollment, the purple being, undergraduate, and then FTE, emphasizing FTE for retention and revenue purposes as well. But right now, there's about a 1.4% difference. We're 20,178 at the census, which is still holding strong. That's well above 20,000, and even after the drop for non-payment. Just some interesting stats that I would point out to you on this page. The good to know from the need to know. The undergraduate enrollment is, I would say, refer to it as flat. It's a difference of 0.3% or 58 students. Graduate is lagging just a little bit there. It could pick up with some, we're working on that. But as we've said in previous board meetings, the part-time enrollment is down, but that's, we believe, is a factor of the economy improving and many of the part-time and non-traditional students heading back to work and employment. If you go to the bottom right of that document, you'll see the non-trads. That's some of the interesting good to know. The need to know, I'd flip over to the back side of that report, which would be the first-time full-time baccalaureate degree-seeking students. These are the freshmen that have come in this year. This is the cohort that CPE grades us upon, and that's holding nicely. We're at fall 2014. The student counts are 2,805. And as you go down that line, it's consistent with our September meeting, our predictions, our expectations. The average ACT has improved slightly, the average GPA, and as you can imagine, the retention rate from 71.7 to 73%. So improvement there. And those are some nice stats to be able to report of the strength of the class, the strength of the freshman class, the first-time freshman class coming in. You can go all the way down that list there, first-time, first-year. Interesting data. I asked an IR put together the top high schools, Bowling Green, Barron County, South Warren, all those. Last year, if you remember, a year ago this week, some of those were suffering, and those were improving. We've done some reordering and intently put emphasis on our local schools here in the footprint of Dr. Lux and his team, and we're seeing some real positive results with these top five high schools, obviously high schools across the region, but these are just some immediate ones that you would know and be familiar with. An interesting point, too, is undergraduate majors. Dr. Bonaguro would be pleased to see the Bachelor of Science in Nursing is one of our leading top five majors these days, followed by education. And biology, interdisciplinary studies, and on from there. Top right of the corner, the KCTCS transfer numbers are up. I believe, you know, usually in the fall you don't see necessarily tremendous jumps in transfer numbers, but this is again a product of the nine joint admissions agreements, of which all but two of those are KCTCS agreements, and that you're going to continue to see that grow as well, and we're looking to, at others to sign here in the coming months. As we go down in-state, out-of-state, I found it very interesting the five states that are driving us. Florida now is becoming one of the top five states. Again, our out-of-state recruitment, out-of-region recruitment is beginning to pay off. We're in the early stages of this. I think you're going to continue to see these positive numbers grow fall 15 and 16. And the top five countries internationally, as you can imagine and have heard before, Saudi Arabia leading the pack there. At fall 14, 594 students. China, right behind that. Brazil, and no, that's not a misprint. Raza Tawana, our chief international officer here to my left here with us today, has developed relationships with Brazil, and that cohort will continue to grow, and that is feeding us some very strong population of students, and we're hopeful that that will continue for several years today. We have no reason to believe it will not. Also in your packet is the TIP standard registrar report. Looks like this document, you've seen it before. The only reason I included this one in here is, one, we've highlighted areas that we've improved on in the last year through enrollment management, and in the yellow and pink, nothing new surprises to the board. These are areas that we continue to increase focus and attention on with our returning students. Again, the part-time, full-time play-out dynamic is shown on here. This document was done just a little bit prior to the census, so not to be confused, this is the actual official census document that goes to CPE. I believe you also have, not to over-inundate you with data, but I think it's important to share this information, the average ACT, which I mentioned earlier, has improved, and there's a, you know, a philosophy or a belief, and it's certainly bearing out with us, that as that average ACT improves, certainly the average retention as well for our first-time, first-year students. In 2012, the average ACT was 21.4 with a 71.34 retention rate. In 13, jumped to 22, 71.72, and then this fall right now, currently, the average ACT is 22.7 with a 73.1 retention rate. Again, only reason I mention that is the strength of the class, that there are very positives in this freshman class, as you see that bubble of freshman move to sophomore, junior, and on to commencement.
Can I interrupt you, Brian, real quick?
Sure.
I want to stress the numbers here. It's a little confusing, perhaps. The fall 2012 numbers, the 21.4 is the ACT score they had in fall 11 when they entered. And 71.34% of those retained. The ACT score went up to 22, and then a year later, 71.72 of those returned. The fall of 2013 ACT score, as you said in your earlier chart, was the 22.7 and 73.1 of those. We remains to be seen, of course, how many of the current fall of 14 class will be retained, but the ACT score went up another 0.7 of a point. So there's a point still to be placed on this plot, which is what retention rate will be for the current class. So there's every reason to believe it will be even higher than that 73%, because the ACT score is significantly greater than it was in the earlier class. And that's assuming simply the raw material, that the ACT score drives retention. As the board is well aware, we've got several activities in place to retain students at a higher rate than perhaps they would naturally do based on their entry qualifications. So, as Brian said, the class is getting significantly stronger, and that should show up as a positive enrollment bubble going through. Sorry.
Let me add one thought to that. I brought with me our current action plan, and the target retention rate for 14-15, the year we're in right now, was 75%, and we'll measure that this time next year, and following the correlation that Gordon just described, as our admission standards have increased and our ACT score has moved up, we fully expect that to result in a like increase in retention, and I'm confident that we will achieve the 75% retention rate targeted in our action plan for the current year as a result of the data you see here and what we will be measuring at the end of FY15, which we'll present to you this time next year.
The bar graphs, too, as we mentioned, kind of tells you it's rather hopeful. First-time freshmen applied, admitted, and enrolled. You come across from fall 10 to fall 14, and that's tracking very nicely. Just this past week, Dr. Lux and Dr. Ramsdale and several of us went to Owensboro and admitted the 2019th student.
Can I go to that?
I'm sorry. Yes, yes. yes, you were there in spirit. How about that? There's a story there, but we had a great fun. The student and his family were very pleased. But the point in this document is the apps are up and the admits are up, and so I think you're going to see some real positives. That's just freshmen, again, all undergraduates on the next page, and then graduate following that. Only reason I include those is to kind of give you a slice of what is expecting in the coming months. Newfound energy there with, as I've mentioned to you before, in the Office of Admissions, working very strongly with the Transfer Center, which is open this fall, which will help us with our transfers, as well as working with many of the retention initiatives Dr. Russ Curley is rolling out and about to roll out further, some very intrusive concepts there to work with faculty and departments. There'll be more to come on that, maybe even have Dr. Curley come and present to the board at some point soon. I don't want to underestimate the international piece either. Does everyone know Roz? Roz, stand up just a second. Roz Kawan, our Chief International Officer for Global Recruitment, and and Dr. Cobain is the Chief International Officer for our programming in the Year of Ecuador and all those sorts of things, and they all work very closely hand in hand. But ROTHA has developed some very strong relationships across the globe that are feeding this growth. You know, last year, fall 13 was 43.2% growth in internationals. Fall 14 is approximately 28%. That's really no small potatoes when you're talking about enrollment, revenue, and the diversity of campus. So that's a snapshot of where we are. The magic number is 20,178. I expect great things for fall of 15 and 16, and I know we have still the spring semester to go to see where we are with that, but that's kind of where enrollment is today, the state of enrollment today.
Let's hear about Brazil a little bit more. How did we snag 150 more students from Brazil?
The Brazil government actually has a scholarship program that they outsource to the IIE, that's nonprofit in Washington, D.C. Basically just making the connection with them, and every school in the United States is really going strong after these scholarship kids. But one, they're all complete on full ride scholarship. Two, they're very highly motivated and high achievers. Some of the deans here, especially John Bandera and Cheryl, have a lot of these students in their colleges, and they're very impressed with the quality of the students. So it's basically networking with them, trying to convince them that we have the infrastructure here to accommodate. These students have different sort of billing cycles, admissions requirements. They have a lot of different needs that the government expects the institutions to fulfill that. So we started with a small group of 14 the first semester, worked out really well, and then we had 151.
So did you travel to Brazil or? Yeah.
Brazil and D.C., in between that, that's where I actually just got back from Brazil to D.C.
To further elaborate, one of the things that ROTHA has been very successful at doing is creating cohorts of students from given countries, Saudi Arabia being a similar context, but he's working with other countries too, where the government will pay the tuition through a government-funded scholarship program and send a group of students together, and they go through together, and the challenge is to sustain when one cohort finishes, there's another one to take its place. Those are relationships that ROTHA has been able to build really with governments of countries more so than with specific students in that evolving dynamic where a lot of countries are putting some serious public money or tax money into scholarship programs. The King Abdullah Scholarship in Saudi Arabia is a little bit different, but that's, you know.
But we just signed an agreement this past summer with the government of Oman, so we're expecting 27 to come in spring, the Oman students.
What government was that?
Oman. Yeah. Exciting piece, too, is, you know, we do open, many of you know and have participated in open houses across Kentucky and Tennessee and everywhere else, and ROTHA and team are going to do an open house in China, December?
Yes.
Keep your passport up to date. Brian, you have anything else?
If I might, Mr. Chair, let me just mention a couple things that I think are important from a governing board perspective. You can quickly get to a bottom line on this sheet right here, and you see the yellow and the red. The yellow are some good news. The red are signs that we have work to do going forward. But if you go to the far right column, go down, and you look at total undergraduate, and you see 17 as a positive, and then you go down to total graduate, and you see minus 219. Therein lies a significant challenge for us. We have turned into a positive context undergraduate full-time, first-time full-time numbers that we struggled with last year and the first down year we had in a long time. We still are fighting through graduate enrollments, particularly part-time graduate students. That's a lot of them are getting jobs, and we've talked about this before, but part-time non-traditional students continues to be a challenge for us, and we have every intention of offsetting those numbers with full-time traditional students, but progress was made this year. If you're looking for how this correlates with dollars, The revenue from this enrollment profile is $592,000, or 0.7% short of our revenue target for this year, for this fall semester. And that budget will be balanced with the non-recurring dollars, carry-forward money for the most part, in our campus budget. So 99.3% of our budget target was achieved, if you want to look at the positive side of that. New full-time enrollment has improved over last year. Quality is up, and you see that data on your information here on the back side of the this enrollment report. So we feel good that the first-time full-time baccalaureate degree-seeking ACT score is 23.39. Retention is beginning to show signs of improvement, as this data suggests. So while it is an academically stronger and more financially stable enrollment profile than last year, we still have work to do to get all indicators on a positive trend line for next fall. So that's how I would summarize this enrollment report.
Dr. Meredith, I have one question. What are we doing on the, we see some drops once you get to, you know, the sophomore to junior, junior to senior status. And to what do we attribute that, and what are we doing with that?
It's a combination of factors. Some of that is financial related. Some of that is...
Yeah, that's what I'm worried about, actually.
Retention related. AARC is working very aggressively to be a little more intrusive than they have in before, and as I sit here, I think I need to probably bring them in and let them talk about those retention initiatives. I referred to the sticky glue, if you will, how to get those folks back in to the, you know, to engage them back into the campus, and Russ and the ARC team are working on that now with intrusive advising, retention coaching, those sorts of things, working with MathWorks. You know, MathWorks is the software that's the indicator that says, hey, there's an alert, a problem here. And then some is financial.
Yeah, that's what I hear as a ground soldier as well. I mean, you know, ground soldier teaching every level of students, and I'm hearing a lot of financial problems, and I think that's something we have to consider going forward.
It's also more really that negative number is not reflect the retention of the sophomore class into the junior class. It reflects a comparison of what used to be the sophomore students.
Right.
To some extent, this is the bubble going through. That, and so I'm very encouraged by the plus 30 in the sophomores, because that should lead to a positive bubble in next year's juniors and the following year's seniors. Got to be a little careful comparing numbers and equating that to retention issues. I think if you looked at last year's report, you'd see a similar negative number in sophomores, and that's just reflected, I think, at a diluted level. That's less than 2% drop. I think, if I recall correctly, the number of sophomores last year was down more than that. So a sophomore junior retention rate is holding fine, I believe.
But you're right, any way you cut it, retention is a huge... continues to be a huge challenge for us.
And
we're fighting to get up to 75% retention freshman to sophomore year and making progress on doing that, and that's our goal. Well, that means you're losing 25%. So, you know, it's a huge challenge for us, and Sharon had something she would like to say.
Just one thing. We have noticed that there's been an increase in our four-year graduation rate. And when students are going through in a more timely fashion than they have in the past, then those numbers from class to class are shrinking, but that's a good thing, because they're getting out of here an average of 4.3 years to graduation. So the other thing that's coming in financially that I think we forget is the new federal standards for satisfactory academic progress. Students who would remain a sophomore or junior for a number of years are not able to qualify for financial aid because they're not making the progress they should. So that puts another stop sign, and those students drop out at that point. So we're graduating the students who are coming in, who are prepared and going through in a more timely manner, and the students who were just parking here for a period of time, so to speak, are not allowed to do that anymore. So we're getting a truer, more refined number going through. So I think that's some of the negative you're seeing as well.
One final compliment, if I might. Over the last few weeks, when we approached the drop for non-payment period, Brian, you'll have more specific numbers, but 500 or 600 students were dropped for non-payment.
470.
470-ish. And as it ended up last week on the final census date, less than 200 lost. The staff in undergraduate advising and financial aid in the bursar's office in Ann Mead shop worked really hard, student by student by student, that had been dropped for non-payment, to re-enroll those students on a payment plan or get them in some type of a financial configuration where they could continue. And we did lose something less than 200. I don't.
And some of those were what I call them paper students. They are students who were not necessarily enrolled. And that's one way of sweeping them.
You don't know that until you take your final census. In many cases. So I just want to compliment our staff in the bursar's office and in financial aid specifically. And Sharon, you worked closely with them in this regard, but they really worked hard, individual by individual, to get those students reinstated to every extent possible.
Actually, in the coming days, Ann and the bursar's office, financial aid, myself, who else, Ann is invited, but we're going to spend an entire day together to evaluate all that process. So we're doing very creative payment plans, and the students are paying for payment plans, which is good, but we want to make sure that that's the most efficient use to support the students and have infrastructure out there. So that's coming up very soon. It'll help everybody.
Before we end this discussion on retention, I'd like to first of all recognize our student newspaper, this week's issue, that has several articles that pertain to our discussion. One was our plans to improve enrollment and then improve retention methods. But the lead article, as many of you saw, was a mouse. And I was pleased to know that we do have someone on campus, one of our biology professors, Noah Ashley, who is doing some pretty nice research on sleep and sleep deprivation. And the reason I mention this is that there is abundance of evidence out there from various sources, including in Minnesota, where by delaying school starting times for adolescents, the students slept 5 hours more a week on average. Their retention rates went up, their enrollment went up, their academic performance goes up, and their athletic performance goes up. So if we have a professor here on campus that's doing work in that, I think it might behoove all of us to learn a little bit more about what he's doing, even though he is mainly focused on health effects of it in mice. But there is a ton of evidence out there, and I think as we talk about retention rates and enrollment, it's worth our consideration and discussion individually in small groups and as a board eventually to see, are there areas there that we could perhaps impact these numbers even further?
How does the mouse performance improve if they get more sleep?
They're probably happier.
Well, you know, you don't have to have mice to figure that out, because with MRI, functional MRI studies today, they can show how human brains do function much better when they have adequate sleep. They can even target areas of the brain that don't function well, particularly in math and sciences. And this is a population of people that in the 12 to 23 or 4 age group that physiologically are different. They have this phase shift and they don't get melatonin production till about midnight, and their normal biological clock would not have them wake up till about 9 in the morning. And in fact, if you talk to teachers in high school, and I suspect it would be true on campus too, many of the students sitting in class at 7:30 or 8 are really not very engaged. So, I mention it because we're talking about retention rates and enrollment, and these are salient factors with that. So, I feel like in 10 years, you know, you won't see high schools or college campuses having classes much before 8:30, 9 in the morning.
I don't know. I had a bunch of them. David had.
As chairman, I got the last word.
The report concludes academically. We will take a 10-minute break and see you back here soon.
That's a good thing. Good job.